part of the conversation. Send us a WhatsApp message on +27 73 470 3520 or call us at +27 12 001 7679. Let your voice be heard. Adventist World Radio, powered by SID Media. From broadcast to baptism.
20 to 8 on the dot. Good morning if you're joining us. Melissa Ndivini is my name. You are listening to The Glorious Morning only on AWR, powered by SID Media. And we're talking about humans this morning. I'm excited for this one. It's been a while. Joined by Pastor in Training, Mlilo Busani. And I'm very happy to have you on board. Good morning, Putfisani. Long time. Hey, but Mlilo, how are you?
Good morning, Millicent. Good morning to your listeners. I'm well. How are you doing?
I am all right under the circumstances. Thank you very much for asking. And yes, I'm looking forward to the conversation. Speaking about Batu, you know, when you think about humanity, sin is one of the characterization that defines us all. Is there more to us than such a negative description, though? I think that is what we want to unpack as we talk about the nature of man. Let's hear your opening line up, Abudim Lilo. What would you say?
Okay. What I would say is that for us to understand our nature, we need to understand our origin, if I were to put it that way. Because we are not of our own. We are creatures that have come out of or off the hand of the Creator. Mm-hmm. And we cannot discuss or understand fully who we are outside the context of understanding who created us, you know. So I wanted to start by saying that, to quote actually from 1 Timothy 6, verses 16, I will read it in your hearing.
Okay.
1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 16, it says, just hold on.
I can read it for you. I've got it. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 16 says, who alone is immortal and who lives in unapproachable light, whom no one has seen or can see. To him be honor and might forever. Amen.
Amen. So here Paul is talking about God himself. Mm-hmm. And he says that God is the only one who possesses immortality.
Okay.
And he dwells in a light where which no man can approach. And I want us to also then go back to Genesis 2, verse 17, if you can also read it for us. I think these two will then frame our engagement when we then go further in terms of the nature, our nature as human beings.
Okay. So Genesis chapter 2, verse 17, it reads as follows. But you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die.
Yes. Hmm. So this gives us a view that as men or as created beings, we do not have immortality. Our bodies or the way that we are constituted, we do not have immortality. We have actually conditional mortality. In other words, our being or our existence or our being alive is actually dependent on God himself. And we can see there in the Garden of Eden that God pronounces, actually he makes that very clear. You know, we know and understand that the tree of good and evil was just a test of obedience. In itself, there was nothing that could, lead to death. It was a test of obedience. And we see that conditional mortality was based on whether we obey God or not. So when we then further go on to then discuss the other aspects, maybe as how did we then maybe move from this idea, which is clear from the Old Testament, that we are not created immortal, that we are dependent on God, and if we do not obey God, we will meet eternal destruction. We need then to look at it and say, but how do we come to a point where now it seems that even as Christians, we teach that we are immortal, you know?
I wanna touch on that, absolutely.
Yeah.
Just to simplify it, so that we all are on the same page. Whenever we have like these words that are concepts, big words, I want us to break it down to make sure we all know what we mean by this. Okay, mortality, an adult might know what mortality rates are and all that. So mortality basically means the state of being subject to death, meaning that it's the idea that you don't live forever, or something disintegrates or degenerates or eventually will meet its demise. That's what mortality means.
Yeah.
So what you have been saying in your opening statement is that human beings are not going to live forever, or as we are right now, we cannot live forever. We will die. And then you quoted verses in the Bible, and you started out with we went to Genesis at least, where it says that if you eat of this tree, you will surely die. And then you went to the other one in Timothy that says that only God can live forever, because he's God. Human beings can't live forever, which is very confusing. And I think that's where you want to go to next about Christianity, that it's not just people from other religions who believe that there's life forever. It's not just Rastafarians who believe that there's life forever. It's not just the Hindu people who believe that there's life forever, the Buddhists or the Sikhs. No. Even Christians believe that when we die, we continue living. And they'll talk then about how you die in the physical body, but you don't really die. And then that's where the words like soul come in. And so your soul lives forever. It continues to live. And that's where even with ancestral religions, the notion that you are able to speak to those who were in your family before you, you can always go to them and talk to them, because they dead in the body, but they actually are alive in the spirit. I'd like you to try and clarify that, please.
Okay. just maybe to actually also further frame the origin of that distortion, because we need to go to the origin of the distortion of saying that we will live forever. I just want to quickly touch on Genesis 3, verses 4. Actually, this is the point where the devil is having a conversation with Eve about the tree, which she is not supposed to eat. And then Eve says, you know, God said that we must not eat or touch this tree, lest we die. That is in verse 3.
Yeah.
This, Genesis 3:3, that's what Eve says. Then the devil responds and says, in verse 4, he says, and the serpent said unto the woman, you shall not surely die. So now this is the discussion that has been going on for the past 6,000 years on whether we shall surely die or we will not die. And that is why we are having this conversation. And maybe just briefly before I get into the question that you brought up now, if we look at the process of how man is brought into being, it says that God formed man out of the dust of the earth.
Right.
Right. He took the dust of the earth and he made the human body. Right. So when man was just a body, he was not a living being. Okay. It was just a body.
Okay.
There was nothing there. You know, because sometimes we even have this problem where people are even more scared of dead people than those who are alive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then it goes on to say that then God breathed the breath of life into his nostrils. He breathed into him and he became a living soul. So now if we were to kind of like look at the mechanics of it, it's like in a, trying to simplify it as best as we can. It's like we've got a body which has been made from dust, you know, and then God breathes, he breathes into it, and this body becomes a living person, or a it would even say living soul. So when people talk about the soul, there is nothing called a soul is a living person. If you actually go into other verses in the Bible, you will find that if you read the story of Paul's shipwreck, when they were counting the people there, it says there were so many living souls that were saved shipwreck, which gives us an idea that when we talk of a person is a living soul. You understand? Okay. So there's nothing like a soul separate, moving or floating somewhere. No.
So where does the idea come from?
Exactly. That's where we are going. And I want to further say, of course, Ecclesiastics further gives us, you know, the mechanics, the picture of those mechanics when it comes to the aspect of what? Of the destruction, or when a person dies, to say, look, you know, King Solomon says there's no difference between a human being and an animal, because you experience the same thing at death. You all return to the dust. You all return to dust, and that's where it ends. So yes, we need now to actually then trace this thing and try to understand, to say, where did this confusion come from? Yes, I have already alluded to it, to say, if you look at it, the deception was already put or framed there in Genesis 3, verse 4, by the devil himself. But now, from a historical perspective, if you study the Old Testament, the word Sheol, which we find in the Old Testament, is actually means the grave. It actually means the grave.
What's the word?
Sheol. Let me spell it. Sheol.
Oh, okay.
Yes. So that's the word you find in the Old Testament, which is translated. This is a Hebrew word,
mm-hmm.
which you find in the Old Testament, which is then translated grave. So when even what's his name, Job talks about, you know, Sheol, he's talking about the grave, and in the Hebrew concept, or in the Hebrew mind, they understood that Sheol or grave or hell meant that you are in the grave, you die and you are buried, and you have no consciousness. You know, when you go to also to Ecclesiastics, he says there, King Solomon says there, the dead know nothing. They have no part whatsoever what happens under the sun. You know, they have no involvement either in voice or in action. They are actually inactive, you know. So I'm trying to lay that foundation. But then you see, there was an impact of the Hellenization on the Hebrew concept. Okay.
Okay.
So what happened is that when Alexander the Great, which is the according to the prophetic visions of Daniel, it is the third kingdom, right? Because we've got Babylon, then we've got Medo-Persia, then we've got the Greek kingdom. So when it came into power, There is what we call the Hellenistic or Hellenization of the whole world of that time, where Greek was taught in all and throughout the empire. And the Hebrew people were actually did not escape that. I mean, we understand this for us who have been colonized. We understand that today we are speaking English, today we are speaking Afrikaans, because this became the language of what? Of education, the language of trade. So what that meant was that the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, had to be translated into the Greek of that time, because that it became the dominant language. And in that Hellenization process, a lot of ideas then came in, which changed the concept of the understanding of this word shower. Okay. Mm-hmm. So now, remember the Greek, they had their own what we call Greek mythology. Mm-hmm. So we also then see how paganism then comes in that way. And then they then translated. So now this translation from Sheol to Hades or Gehenna, from the Greek mythology aspect, Hades meant a totally different thing from grave or Sheol.
Okay.
It actually meant a place where dead people go, and if you are good, or there is a place of torment and all. So there was a corruption of the original meaning of the word, because when they were translating the Greek the Hebrew scriptures into Greek. So when it came to the word Sheol, they then put Hades, which we understand comes from Greek mythology. Maybe let me end there for now.
So what I hear you say is basically that these concepts from the original language through various experiences, the meeting of other languages that then became the hegemonic languages of that time, and certain cultural experiences, like, for example, entertainment, maybe, or just yes. like mythology, like you're explaining, so their religious understanding of things, maybe, that those concepts became more popular than the meaning of the original text. And yeah. obviously then if entertainment is brought through because of stories, and we love stories, and they are passed down from generation to generation. Yes. Yeah. Then they became the popular meanings that have been ascribed. And so when we talk about some concepts today, you mentioned Hades, you mentioned Sheol, like the soul as well, then we end up being confused or having different interpretations. But because none of us speak those original languages, we actually end up fighting about something that could probably be resolved if only we understood the original languages and where the concepts originates. But because maybe we don't have that insight, we just assume that the popular term is the correct understanding, when that is not necessarily always the case. Did I get you correctly?
Yes. Okay. 100%. 100%. It's you know, Millicent, my little experience going through theology is, you know, going through church history, you actually see the journey of the Christian church. And when we look at church history, we are saying that the church did not grow, or did not come up and grow in a vacuum, but it was actually, you know, there were influences around it.
Communities.
Whether political, whether economical, whether cultural, and the impact of the Greek. In fact, all those civilizations which we see outlined by the prophets of Daniel, they had an impact in how we, you know, the doctrine has been shaped. One of the things that comes up is that that actually gave to this influence is that actually the church fathers during the Greek time, they were schooled or educated from a Greek perspective.
Okay.
And here these are the men that were actually writing out some of the most some of the doctrines that we still have today. They were formulated by these men, and we cannot underestimate the Greek impact or the Hellenization impact in their view of, you know, of doctrine and all that. So there was a period. In fact, when you study the church history, it will give you a view that there was a time when the church actually needed to articulate itself and, you know, frame beliefs, as we would call them, doctrines today, you know, because there was also a within the church itself, people would come up with other ideas about things. For instance, the nature of Christ, you know, even the issue that we are discussing today. And then it then prompted these church fathers to actually come up with positions. And we call them the apologists, come up with papers that will actually frame, you know, how the church, based on scripture, understands things. But obviously, like I'm saying, the other challenge was that the language was changing from Hebrew. Now they were Greek Christians, but even before that, before even we come to the period of the New Testament, so the period the challenge was is not only a scene when we come to deal with the New Testament, but even when we go back when it was just the Old Testament available, when they had to translate it. I'm talking about like 500 years before Christ, when they had to translate it into the Greek, you know, language. We, of course, we know it as the LXS, So that work, whenever you have to translate something, whenever you have to try and make something, you know, available in different languages, there is always a challenge to maintain the original intention or nuisance. So there are changes that happen, and today when we sit and we are battling with this thing of the immortality of the soul, this is just Greek mythology, really.
Sure. Yeah, no, that is hectic. We are speaking to Elder Mlilo Busani, and this morning we're looking at the nature of human beings, and we are encouraging you to weigh in on the conversation. What have you discovered maybe throughout the years as you have been studying, or what has confused you as you have been hearing different perspectives, perhaps, and you want to share that with us this morning? Our WhatsApp number for that is +27734703520. We've got a comment coming through from the Lindsay family. Good morning. Barry, thanks for the conversation, Millicent. This is why it was necessary for the text first to be forced into Greek. Original Hebrew thought wouldn't allow some of these heretical concepts to see the light of day. I think that's a good point coming through, Awudim Lilo. And I think those who do get the opportunity to study theology have so much grace, and they can be very impactful in articulating that to us lay people who have not been exposed to those other languages, because it's jargon, you know, and you now also understand how that jargon came about. And we also know that with the writing of the Bible, with the different translations, we've heard that, oh, there are translations where texts have been taken out of the Bible, for example, or someone knew perhaps deliberately that, oh, we don't want to use this particular word because we don't want the meaning to remain original. Therefore, kapilo empi, that person, you know, or those people who in certain translations decided, let's incorporate our skewed a meaning by using a word that is not the right word really, but because on a agenda, then that's what you do. And it's unfortunate because now many people, I don't know about our, I think our African languages, we only have one translation per language, right? We don't have different translations in our African languages. Highly, if you got a Zulu Bible, it's, there's only one Zulu Bible. There aren't many different versions of the Zulu Bible, unlike with English, which has many different translations. Am I correct? So meaning that, meaning that whatever you find and you have, that's it.
Yes. So we cannot overemphasize the importance of going back to the original language. And also, also Millicent, studying church history for ourselves. You know,
what does church history mean? Let's start there. Before you, what do you mean when you say studying church history?
All right. When, what I mean is that we, as Protestants, we cannot be full Protestants and not know the history of the Christian church, from how it came out of Judaism. You know, how Christianity came out of Judaism. We cannot be full Protestants and not have a background of, you know, how we got here. It's like, you know, when we talk about our individual journeys or identities as people, to say it's important to, for you to know who you are, you must understand your journey from the very beginning, you know. So when you get then exposed to that, you get to see how things happened and why certain things are the way they are today. I also wanted to say, so I was sitting in a Greek class. I want to talk to this issue of the different versions of Bibles that are circulating. So our Greek professor says the honest truth is that there is only one text that we all need to learn. Because anything else that we are learning is just an attempt, and we need to it's just an attempt to try and capture that original text. And we need to then understand that there is a continual drift away from the intended meaning, number one. And number two, there is always the risk of someone putting in their own things. Because the question was, why do we have, I don't know how many English versions of the Bible we have, you know? And sometimes when you really sit down and you read the same verse, but in different versions, you actually get a different meaning. If you actually critically look at it and read it, you would actually get a different meaning, you know? So from our Greek lessons, we talk of the Byzantine text, and we talk about that God, for some reason, allowed that language be used because of its less of turnover in change. You know, because when we're comparing it, for instance, to the English language, do you know that the English language, the cycles that it has gone through in terms of changing, the English language is one language which can assimilate different words from other language very quickly. And this happens very oftenly. So that, for instance, let me give you an example. As I was preparing for our discussion, the word hell is actually coming from Old English, which is Helena, which means to cover or hide. Okay, which means to cover or hide. So when you talk about the grave is hell, because you are put in the grave, so you are covered or hidden, you know, put away from the living eyesight. Mm-hmm. When Abraham speaks and he asks for the cave to bury his wife Sarah, he says to them, Give me a burying place where I can put away my dead, away from my sight. So you are covered, you are hidden from sight. So hell and grave, it means the same thing, you know. But then, obviously, when we know, so the, Helena is all English, which is where the where hell is actually drawn from.
Yeah,
you understand.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Now the reason why we they always emphasize to say the King James Bible is actually the closest. If we come to all the English versions, is the closest you can get in terms of trying to get the original meaning and the nuances of words as they were used at the time, you know. But the English language also, like I've already mentioned, that is there are too many
translations. That's true.
Always change.
I was actually looking at what people, what research says here. I can't give you a clear answer, but it's anything between 60 and 450. Different English translations. Imagine.
What's the objective of having so many translations?
Imagine.
And like I'm saying, words, the English words, they keep changing. Let's talk about the word gay.
Mm-hmm.
Gay in to the be old happy. English meant to be happy, to be in a light mood and all that. But now you when we say gay, it can mean a whole different thing.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah.
So going back to the question of the history of the church, we want to understand, or we need to understand, we need to study and understand to say the writings that we find in the Bible themselves, they were framed, or there was an influence on how they came into being. Mm. We know and understand that the Bible is divinely inspired, but God did not detect every word that is written. Man was allowed to express himself using his own words. And when we look at the circumstances surrounding the authors, you know, the time they wrote and all those things, they do have an impact on how things then come out, you know. So it's important to study church history as well, so that we understand fully, or we can have a full picture of what is being conveyed to us.
Okay, granted, I totally hear you. You know, sometimes when you read the Bible, there are people who come across as perfect. This thing of human beings are mortal, that's the one character description that you gave us. The other one that comes to my mind is that for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. So human beings, then each and every single human being has sinned. But some people's sins are not recorded. Does that mean that even like people in the Bible especially, even if we don't know what their sins are, can we still say that they are sinful? And then we also know that there are people who did go to heaven. Moses, Elijah, Enoch. Moses, we know he sinned because he got punished for it after he did a number of things. He killed an Egyptian, he hit the rock twice, all those things. Elijah, he probably sinned. Okay, I mean, we all sinned, right? But Enoch, there's no record of that, and we don't hear that Enoch died and was resurrected. So his sin is not mentioned, and we don't have a record of his death. Do people like Enoch, someone like Enoch, would we say they still meet this description of a human being mortal and sinful?
All right, so I think this helps us to actually, it's a beautiful question, because it helps us to kind of like look at, I mean, why does God create man out of clay, something that seems to be perishable, something that seems to be that doesn't seem to be eternal. And then why does he then put a test for man, a kind of like a probation of some sort? Why does he do that? Was there an intention from God's perspective to say that if Adam passed that test, maybe there was going to be a promotion? You know, because if we go a little bit back, because the question you are bringing actually is, we need to lay a large background,
mm-hmm,
so that we can answer it properly. Because we understand that by the time that Adam and Eve are created, and the world is created, we understand that rebellion has already happened in heaven. And, you know, Lucifer has become Satan, the adversary of God. And there is a conflict that is happening already in the entire universe. And God goes on to create man, and he gives a test of obedience. And that, I think that's very important. He gives a test of obedience. And he creates him out of something that seems to be not permanent, you know. So for me, it gives me a view that God had an intention of bestowing immortality at some point. But a man had to be tested, you know, to be seen whether he would be fit to actually be in that state or promoted to that position of immortality. So then when we look at, then now when we come back to the lives of people like Enoch, the Bible says Enoch walked with God and he was normal, mm-hmm, because God took him. And we understand what it actually means is that God translated him and went with him to heaven. Now, when we look at the process of translation, we do understand that there is actually a change, which Paul actually supports, I think, in Thessalonians, where, mm-hmm, he says, in the twinkling of an eye, I do not know whether it's Thessalonians, maybe I got it wrong, says, in the twinkling of an eye, we shall all be changed. A mortal will put on immortality. So there is a translation that we are waiting for, because we understand that we have been created with these perishable bodies. Our bodies are perishable. They will die. We are dying actually daily. There's a beautiful sermon which Pastor Moyos actually preached in one of our, and it was not a good day, but one of our services where one of our brothers passed away.
Mm.
And he said, he gave a concept to say that we are all dying. As I'm speaking to you and as you are listening to me, you are dying and I am dying, you know, because the pronouncement of death is upon all human beings, because I don't want to preach, but Paul then says, by one man, sin came into the world and then death. And also by the one man, you know, life has come, eternal life has come. Where Paul then contrasts, you know, the first Adam and Christ, who is said to be the second Adam. So we understand that our bodies were created to we were created that we could perish if we were not obedient.
Mm.
So it seems there was a probationary, we are on probationary time, basically. But there is an opportunity for us to gain immortality when we are proved to be faithful to God. Therefore, Enoch then is translated, because in his journey, he then proved faithful and obedient, and he proved that he could be placed in a world of eternity. That is how I understand and how I see it, Millicent.
Mm.
So yes, we have all sinned, and not So I've already made that contrast to say, but because of Adam's sin, we all sinned.
Okay.
But God on the other end is saying, because Christ has been righteous, we have an opportunity to be righteous just by accepting Christ's work, what he did for us. You know, then we are pronounced righteous and we can get that immortality that we want.
There's a comment that has come through to say, but this shows how our Father is not a coward. Understanding right well the different factors, he knew his children, true worshippers at least, will find him in the maze. Oh, Sana. And a question for you, Abu Timlilo, was Christ also fully a man? Was he a sinful man like me, or is he exempt since we know that he took on humanity?
Beautiful question. Very important. So if Christ was not fully man, he could not then take the punishment of man. Neither could we benefit from his work. He had to be fully man. He had to be. And the Bible goes at length to actually give us that view. So this is interesting, Millicent. Because even in the early church, these were the discussions and the questions that the church had, on the nature of Christ. So he had to be fully man, because it says in all points he was tested, yet he was found without sin. He could not use any other power to overcome that is not available to us. It means he could sin. He could sin. He did not have the propensity to sin.
Ow.
Why? Right. So now we need to understand. So why was Christ born of a virgin? Because I've always asked people this. I remember some time back, I asked a pastor this question to say, who is Christ's father? You know, who's Christ's father? And the Bible is clear that the Christ's father is God himself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And because Joseph wasn't his father, his father was not human. When we go back to Genesis, it says the seed of the woman. There is no man's seed there. And what that actually gives us. All right, there's another book that I will urge our listeners to look for. It's a book called Conquering the Dragon. I can't remember the author, but I know if you Google sometimes it can come up. So in this book, Millicent, the author says that we need to understand how temptation happens. I'm trying to then talk to the nature of Christ.
Yes.
We need to understand how temptation happens. And it says that with Adam, if we look at the temptation of Adam, Adam did not have any evil thoughts coming from within himself. You know, when Christ speaks to the Pharisees about their ceremonial washings, he says that, about what man eats and what defiles a man. He says that what you eat does not defile you, but that which comes from inside you, that which is in your heart. In your heart, there is theft, there is murder, there is adultery. So the things that come from within you defile you. But now, if we go back, and we look at the nature of Adam, because we are talking about the nature of man, not only just from a physical perspective, but even from a spiritual understanding. If we go back to Genesis, we understand that Adam was created noble and pure. Within himself, there were no evil thoughts. Adam did not even have one single evil thought, Millicent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So temptation could only come from outside.
Okay.
You understand that? Temptation could only come from outside. It wasn't like what we have now, where we ourselves, the man sitting at the pool of Bethesda for 38 years, who could not even move or do anything. Christ says to him, go and sin no more. That man was immobile, but he was sitting there, perhaps his thoughts. You know? I'm just trying to emphasize that point. So now, I don't want to preach. So now, Adam could only, temptation could only come from outside. And that's why, that was the case with Christ. That's why we say he's the second Adam. That's why God goes at length to actually have his birth the way it is. Because he doesn't inherit any propensities to sin like we had, like we inherited. We have propensities to sin.
That's so why, did you get the answer about then why Jesus was born of a virgin? There's a joke, but David was his father. That's what it says, you know, his line, his lineage. Why then a virgin? What? Because Mary sinned. It's Catholic doctrine is the one that says that Mary was perfect, but all other Christians would not say that Mary was perfect.
No, he was not perfect.
So she was a virgin, but not perfect. So did you get your answer about why then a virgin instead of just a woman, all right, in jail, and, you know, she still lived on the straight and the narrow, and she brings up children well, don't.
Okay, let me cut it short. Sorry, I was like going on a preaching thing there. My point I'm trying to make is that my understanding is that there is this patriarchal aspect of the what we call it. I may not get into the detail of the actual nature and try to go into that, but you see, it seems God makes a deliberate effort to change the patriarchal lineage or line, because ultimately it says Jesus was the Son of God, and actually, if you go to look, there is a genealogy there, which actually says that when it ends, it says Adam was the son of God. You understand? So to me, it suggests that if you follow that patriarchal line, from his nature, he was the son of God, as Adam was the son of God. He had no propensity to sin within himself. He was fully human. He could only experience temptation from outside. So that's why he was tempted in all points. But he was pure from within, just like Adam was pure. That's the short summary I can give within the time that we have.
Okay. Yeah, this is tough. That time we are actually talking about the nature of humanity, and we've touched on many different factors. We've spoken about the Bible, we've spoken about the soul and death, and but I think just used to show how I think all of these Bible theologies are combined. You can't understand anything in isolation. You have to understand it together. And maybe this leads to, I think, an important question, Mlilo, which is why this is even a doctrinal study, the nature of man. Why is it important for us to understand this? Is it necessary for our salvation at all?
It is necessary because one of the things, from my understanding, that Christ says we must be aware of before his second coming. He says, do not be deceived. Do not be deceived. He mentions that several times. He says, don't be deceived. And we have already pointed out the source of deception. Genesis 3 verse 4, where the devil himself says, you shall not surely die. So the problem with this doctrine is that it gives a view that there is no end of probation. I know at some point we studied, you know, the different eschatological views which different denominations have. And you find that in some of these, they give an impression that people will get a second chance, you know, or, you know, a second probation, or that we are all going to be saved, you know. So it's very important for us to really understand the correct view of scripture so that we are not deceived and we find ourselves, you know, time has run out and we have not done the work that we are supposed to do.
Yeah, that's yo. All right, yes, definitely. Let's wrap it up. But Lilo, thank you for being so patient with me, okay? Thank you so much. Are we stuck as human beings in those expected human characteristics? You are born a sinner because Adam sinned. Even if you don't ever really sin, you are still going to be called a sinner because Adam sinned. And then you are, like you spoke about Enoch, the body. He had a mortal body. So his body definitely would have to be changed. He was not He was not Jesus before Jesus was, you know, came, basically. Is there hope for us, given these characteristics that we have? And I asked this question, and I'd like you to give a very comprehensive response, because there are people who, I think, are comfortable in the human nature. You know, the Pope recently in his latest encyclical said something about human beings are magnificent. And I don't know what does that mean? Maybe he does not mean it in a way that's like, what? Magnificent? What makes a human being magnificent? What's magnificent about being human, getting sick and dying and you know, mistreating other people and all these horrible things that we do. Yeah. We do horrible things. We do horrible things. But he said human beings are magnificent. But someone else could speak about, I mean, the Bible says you are fearfully and wonderfully made. You know, maybe he could meet it in that context to say, hey, there's something about this body that is, there's a lot that can be studied about the human body and human nature, resilience and stuff like that. Okay, maybe. But I guess even that, you would need power from outside to be resilient and to be, you know, I don't know if those things come from within us, Njay. And there are people who are comfortable, and sometimes that's where the grace ideology also comes in. Woodsy, no, we now living under grace. And I've played people who have shared, like, spoken bluntly that, what kind of a God is this? What kind of a God is this who teases us with a nature that he knows we're going to fail, but he still teases us through that? And I'll give you at least maybe a few examples. How can you say as God to Abraham, go and take your son and, you know, butcher him basically? And then as he's about to do that, you're like, I'm joking. Here's the real animal for you to sacrifice. And someone is like, what kind of a God would do that? And then someone else is like, I just don't get it. So I was born in this body. You telling me that I'm a sinner, and you telling me that I can come to you and you'll change me and blah, blah, blah. But you made me. And you knew that I was going to be born a sinner. So basically you should have made me a robot so that I don't sin. Because now it's your fault that I do sin. You know, it's your fault. And you want me to take control of something that you're supposed to take control of. And now you're gaslighting me because you don't want to own up. You understand how people will reason these things out? Yes. So this body and this nature of being human does get complicated when you realize that, ish, who does the buck stop with actually? Pila pila. Are we stuck with these human characteristics? And maybe you want to speak for God.
Okay. What I can say, Millicent, is that somebody said we are born, we do not have a choice, you know, in being born into this life. I don't think we have a choice of being born into this life. But once we are born, we are given an opportunity to either live a short life and perish and be like we never existed before. You know, there is that actually terminology in the Bible where he says when people will be destroyed, it will be like they never existed. Or we've got an opportunity to grasp immortality, right? So as things stand right now, with what you have said, we are in a poor shape in all aspects. There is nothing going right in the world. There's nothing going right in us or the way we carry ourselves. We have fallen short. And maybe for us to put it a little bit simpler in a way, when we say sin, we are sinners or we sinned, we are simply saying we have transgressed the laws of God. And I want to try and put this in a way that will make us really understand. To say that if we look at governments, for instance, I mean, we've spoken extensively about this thing. If we look at governments, if we look at communities, they are always aspiring to have a life that is, that is free from hurt and pain. And each society seems to agree on a code of living or on principles that must govern existence. So when we basically talk about that we have sinned, we are saying that there are principles that govern existence or that helps us to live a life full of love and all the things that we want, which we have not managed to attain to, right? So we need to understand it from that context. And because of that, we are in this circle of misery and degeneracy that we are going through. Things are not getting better. We are actually degenerating in our ways and also in our being, you know. So like I said from the beginning, I think God came up with a plan to say, look, let me give them an opportunity, a probation. That's why we always talk about a probation. Where did we get this concept that people at work must have a probation, Millicent? You are given a probation. Why are you giving a probation? You know, we want to be able to see whether you can deliver as you should. And I know that in the period of a probation, from a work perspective, you are then capacitated to actually, be able to deliver what you need to deliver. And I believe that God has given us a probation, you know, so that, and through grace, he is capacitating us so that indeed we can be transformed and grasp and reach and get hold of immortality that is within our reach, because it is. Many men have done it. Like you said, Enoch has done it. Enoch did it. Moses did it. Elijah did it. Christ himself, he did it as a man. So immortality is within our reach. We just need to look at how these men did it, you know, and do it. That's what I would say.
That's what you would say. Yeah. Okay. I was thinking as you were speaking there, Uzi, I actually came across a video titled somewhere, there's no word probation in the Bible, but you hear these adventures always going on about probation. I don't know if that's something you want to touch on before I let you go.
Oh, probation.
Yes. It's jargon for a lot of people.
Jargon. Okay. So we look, when we started off, we spoke about conditional immortality to say, they are life dependent on God, but also being tested, you know, because we understood that Adam and Eve, that tree of life, we understand, was a means to test their obedience. Mm. And if they had succeeded, other authors, they say that if Adam had actually succeeded, that test would have been taken away and they would have been confirmed to be suitable to have immortality. So the idea of a probation is just to say a period where we are tested and God wants to see if we are faithful. And as Christians, we understand this very well, that we are continuously being tested. I mean, the word says it itself. We are continually being tested by God, not only just to find out whether we are faithful, but to also to expose our weaknesses so that we can be capacitated to actually overcome those weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
So probation just means that period of being tested before we are confirmed faithful. That's how I understand it.
Thank you very much for sharing. Thank you so much for being on the platform this morning. We really do appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having
me. Yeah, and the research that you put into, the effort that you put into the conversation, we do appreciate that a lot. May God continue to bless you as you grow in learning and coming to teach us everything from Theology 101. I truly appreciate it. May you be blessed, sir.
Thank you so much. We are all learning. Thank you so much, Melissa.
Adventist World Radio SID Media. We are not general practitioners. We are specialists in Bible-based content.